has about 10 squares unfilled.
But Dan is almost complete. Oh. I know, it's about to happen. How many trophies does one person need, Dan? Really?
Tyler's got annuli. He's got he's got crusts. Almost.
Okay.
What are those? Buddhist things. Sets of Buddhist stories. Finishing at 12 minutes and 51 seconds, but about 7 minutes and some, six-time champion Dan Fair.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The World Within. My guest today is Dan Fair, and if you haven't heard of him before, he is the six-time champion of the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament from 2010 to 2015. How are you doing today, Dan?
I'm great, Joe. Thanks.
Only in the history of the game, only one other man has ever won it more than you. So for this day and age, you're the best crossword puzzle solver in the world. How does it feel to have that title?
Well, it's kind of fun to win a national championship in something. And I was a little bit lucky to win six times in a row. Because I'm not orders of magnitude better solver than everybody else. I'm just a little bit better than everybody else, and was able to win the tournament up until this year, although not to give away what happened. But I lost, couldn't keep the streak going through seven.
Yeah, well, it's not anything to frown upon on this six
right.
in a row. So how does the tournament work exactly?
Yeah, there's about 600 contestants who gather in a ballroom at the Stamford Marriott in Stamford, Connecticut, which is where the tournament was founded in 1978. And everybody solves the same seven puzzles in seven rounds, one at a time. The puzzles vary in size and difficulty. Some of them are like a Tuesday puzzle in the New York Times, relatively simple, and some of them are harder and larger than a Saturday puzzle, which is the hardest puzzle in the New York Times. And we all accumulate points based on how fast we solve, and you lose a lot of points if you make a mistake or accidentally leave a square blank. So usually any sort of error disqualifies you, essentially, from making the final round. And after those seven rounds, the top three contestants in each of three skill divisions, A, B, and C level, with A, of course, being the top, the top three contestants solve a final puzzle in front of everybody up on a whiteboard. And this puzzle is harder than any of the other ones. We're wearing noise-canceling headphones and listening to white noise on a little iPod, because there's commentary. There's commentators talking about this final round. So there's basically a playoff to determine the championship.
And when you do the first puzzles, like in the first round, how quickly do you usually solve the first round puzzles?
The first one is about 2.5 minutes. It's a sort of average time.
Yeah. And the average person who's going out there, how long does it take them usually?
Well, it depends on what the average solver means, because the people that come to the tournament, of course, are all crossword aficionados. Most of them are not coming because they have a chance to win, but because it's like the annual convention for crossword fans. You're seeing your friends, you're hanging out with the crossword celebrities, the editors and constructors who make and edit the puzzles that we all enjoy doing. So there are people who will solve it in 5-6 minutes, which is, of course, very respectable for the general public, but is not going to get you, you know, in the top half of the tournament standings.
And you had mentioned crossword puzzle celebrities, which I'm sure you're among. How does it feel to have that celebrity status when you sort of walk into the convention?
It's I'm not particularly comfortable being the center of attention. I don't love being a star. I work in theater, as you do, but also sort of behind the scenes, as you do. I'm a pianist and music director, so I like being in a dark orchestra pit and accompanying a show or conducting a show, you know, rather than being the star of it. So it's fun to see all. I enjoy seeing all my friends there, and it's not like there's people asking for autographs or fawning over me or anything. Just people say hi or good luck or I'm rooting for you. That sort of thing. My wife enjoys my celebrity a lot more than I do.
They don't ever ask for autographs?
Very occasionally. I mean, it's mostly people who have got a friend of mine who's got a sort of a crossword pattern jacket that she's gotten dozens of celebrity, you know, crossword celebrities to sign over the years. But, I'm not notable enough to really have my autograph be a valuable thing. I never volunteer my sort of claim to fame in a party situation or meeting people for the first time, because it's sort of a hard thing to come up in casual conversation, and I'm not going to just start bragging about it. Because, yeah, half the time it's like a conversation killer. Granted, half the time people are like, oh my god, that's so cool, I love doing crossword puzzles, tell me more. But usually it's a friend or a colleague will introduce me as, this is a crossword champion, and then I have to explain it to everybody, which is okay.
Explain what it's like when you go up onto that final stage with the headphones on and the white noise that you had mentioned. Like, when your first time when you did that, were you, like, crazy nervous, or...?
I actually think that my performing and musical theater background may have helped in that department the first time, because I'm used to performing in front of hundreds or thousands of people. I didn't get terribly nervous having to perform in front of everybody. I mean, I still, even having done it 10 times or so, get a little bit nervous, but as soon as you start, you kind of can focus and not worry about that. The harder thing to get used to is just the physics of it. You know, the physical space is different with a whiteboard on an easel in front of you that you have to sort of reach up to reach the top of the puzzle and kneel down a little bit to get to the bottom, looking back and forth between a paper in my hand, which has the clue on it, and, you know, this giant-sized puzzle. That's actually the weirdest part, is getting used to that, and can be a disadvantage, I think, for people who are trying it for the first time.
Can you explain what makes someone good at crossword puzzles? What are the things in your life do you think that have contributed to you being good at them?
Having a good vocabulary helps. The sort of general verbal skills. I'm not now a huge reader. Like, I don't read a lot of books, although I read sort of periodicals and articles on the internet nowadays, short form things. But always growing up, you know, I read a lot, and so I just knew a lot of words and was able to spell them without thinking about it. I guess spelling is an important part of it too, because if you have to stop and think about any letters, then you're going to lose time in a speed solving situation. I actually won the San Francisco County Spelling Bee when I was in eighth grade and went to the National Spelling Bee. So I've always been a good speller, although I didn't particularly do well in the National Spelling Bee because I was not putting in the kind of study time that requires when I was in eighth grade. I guess retention of the sort of crossword vocabulary is important, but that just came from repetition. After you've done enough crosswords, you just internalize those words that you see over and over that you don't ever see in real life, but they have vowels, a lot of vowels in them, and so they're useful for crossword puzzles. So the practice makes perfect is the main tip, because the more puzzles you do, by definition, the better you're going to get at them. And the other, I guess the other aspect to it is trivia knowledge. I have decent trivia knowledge. I wouldn't win a lot of money on Jeopardy or anything, but I might be able to get on someday. So I've got a sort of a broad base of knowledge, but it's not a deep base.
Yeah. So like someone who's good at Jeopardy wouldn't necessarily be good at crossword puzzles?
Not necessarily. And there are people who are good at both. One of the top five, top 10 speed solvers now for the last few years, June Pak, also won Jeopardy 8 times. That was in the Tournament of Champions. So there are people that that are good at both, but he also knows a lot more trivia than I do. So they're sort of related skills, but not correlation. But there's not necessarily a correlation. You don't have to know details about things to fill them in a crossword puzzle. You just have to know that they are a thing. In any given, if you know that there was a baseball player named Tony Oliva, for instance, Oliva, there are three vowels out of the five letters. It starts and ends with a vowel. Those are the important structural things for crossword-ies, as we call it. So if you know that that is a baseball player of the past, then if you've got a couple of those letters and you see Minnesota Twins or whatever, then you can fill that in even without knowing anything specifically about him.
So what if there's a clue that you just absolutely don't know the answer to it?
The beautiful thing about the crossword grid is that every letter is part of two answers, one going across and one going down. So if you don't have no idea going one way, then hopefully you'll be able to fill in enough of the other letters that you can take an educated guess. Very occasionally, there might be a crossing of two things. There's sort of one letter at an intersection that you might have to guess. But usually you can figure out linguistically what letter will make the most likely word or proper name or foreign word in both directions and guess that successfully. At this point, there are not a lot of answers in crosswords that I've never seen before.
So there's a lot of repetition in the answers to the puzzles?
Yeah, exactly. 3, 4, and 5 letter words, especially that are at least half vowels, especially starting or end or ending with vowels. Just architecturally, those are the words that help a crossword fit together. And so those are the words that come up over and over. They're not even necessarily words, names, foreign words.
Can you tell me about how you prepare for a tournament? And I'm sure besides solving puzzles, there's other things that you do to get ready for the tournament.
There is literally no training other than solving puzzles.
Oh, really?
I have never prepared in any other way.
Okay.
Really. Aside from trying to get enough sleep or whatever. So I think some people make flashcards or something like that of words that they didn't know and then try to study a little bit. But I was not much of a studier in school either, so I'm not going to study for my hobby.
Yeah.
The main thing I do to prepare every year is start solving on paper as opposed to on the computer. Most of the time, I get digital puzzle files. There's a program called Across Light that's the sort of standard crossword solving program on a computer. There are a few others. And so most of the puzzles I do 5 to 10 puzzles a day that come out in various newspapers and magazines and independent websites. I'll just do them on the computer because that's faster, and it's faster for me to type than it is to write. And it obviously saves paper and ink from, you know, printing out all these thousands of puzzles. But the process of solving on a computer is different than printing out and solving on a piece of paper with a pencil. Just because your eyes are going to a different place. You know, when you're on the computer, the clue, you know, wherever the cursor is in the puzzle, that clue is highlighted. So, you know exactly where you're looking to see the clue. But on paper, you know, you answer one clue and then you have to go look for the next one, and you just have to look in the list. So the sort of eye-hand coordination of finding the clue that you want as fast as possible, that getting into that groove is an important part of speed solving, because if you lose like half a second every time you're scanning the clue list for, you know, you're at 37 across, gonna answer that one, okay, then we have to go over to 36 down, it's in a different place. If you add up a bunch of half seconds, then, you know, then you're losing valuable time. So the weeks and months leading up, I will sort of gradually print out the puzzles more often, and, you know, sort of binge solve on paper to just get myself in the groove. And that's sort of like any training for an athletic activity. I think that's where it gets closest to a sport, in that, you know, the eye-hand coordination and the physically being able to write while you're thinking, while you're looking in this place. You know, you try never to... Ideally, your pencil will never stop writing. If it's an easy puzzle where you don't have to think about the clues all that much, you just have to find them fast enough and keep the flow going. That's another sort of developed skill from years of practice.
Yeah, because I've seen some of your videos that you have on YouTube, and I mean, you solve them faster than I can practically read what the clue is.
This is the New York Times crossword for Monday, August 23rd by Oliver Hill. Here we go.
Yeah, people say that they can't even write random letters into the puzzle as fast as that, and I don't quite believe that. Like, you can't even write your name that fast. You know, I'm not a super fast writer or anything like that.
But when you look at the clue, you almost instantaneously know what the answer is, right?
Yeah, on an easy or medium puzzle, and it's just a word association sort of automatic thing. If you see one sort of key word that's always part of the clue, or that will indicate something, indicate an answer, then you just come up with it right away.
Because a lot of those clues are pretty clever. They try to. It's not like a trivia question. You know, it's a sort of a pun sometimes, or a riddle. I can't.
Yeah, exactly. Wordplay, yeah. is what the most fun part of crosswords is using double meanings, triple meanings, any word that has more than one meaning that can be sort of twisted into a different kind of idiom. Playing off of an idiom, or playing off of a proper noun versus a lowercase noun. A word like Nice, the city in France, N-I-C-E, you know, they use that as like nice person. You know, it looks like nice person on, you know, on the paper, but you have to interpret it as Nice. And it'll be a friend, you know, and the answer will be in French or something like that. I guess that wouldn't apply, but... it would be nice one. Question mark. You know, they usually have a question mark to indicate that there's some wordplay, and the answer would be une, you know, U-N-E, which is one in Nice.
This is what so there's all sorts.
there's all sorts of kind of clue tropes that they've used, and then, but again, after solving thousands of puzzles, you almost will think of that first. I will know going in what the difficulty level of a puzzle is, generally. At the tournament, you know, there's sort of a pattern of the easy versus the hard ones. And one of the really advanced skills is you know that in a sort of oblique clue, you're going to be not, you know, not using the most, the surface meaning of this word, but you're going to have to immediately think of the second or even like the third most common meaning. And, you know, that sixth sense I have is to know which one they're going to be going for and sort of think in that realm, and that will sort of get there faster.
Does that sort of affect your everyday life? Do you ever like constantly look at things and try to solve them when there really is no pun or
not really? Not really. That's a sort of crossword constructor or puzzle maker's kind of a brain. I feel like I'm very left-brained, analytical rather than creative. So I'm good at deconstructing, breaking down these things, but not so good at coming up with these clever oblique clues myself. There's sort of an analogy in my musical career. As a musician, I don't write music. I've never been interested in really in creating, writing songs or writing music, but I'm a good arranger and orchestrator, which is sort of part mathematics of taking a song and, you know, improving it or orchestrating it for an ensemble. You know, I've always been better at editing prose than actually writing it myself. So the sort of brain that will look at a sign and know, you know, be able to anagram it or see a double meaning is, yeah, that's not exactly what I have.
Do you ever just like run out of puzzles? Like, where do you get them all from once you've done all the major newspapers of the day?
Yeah, I don't think I will ever run out. And believe me, I've tried to solve them all, but I will never get to all of them, especially since I got a relatively late start. You know, I didn't really start obsessively until I was about 30. There's maybe 5 to 10 a day of new puzzles that come out from newspapers and websites, like I said, some, you know, some daily, some weekly. But there's books of original puzzles that some publishers still put out, original puzzles that were not, you know, reprints from the New York Times or from other publications. So I've got those on my bookshelf. I've got older, you know, books of older puzzles that are from before I started solving, and so you gotta go back and catch up. You know, one of the first things I did when I got hooked is when I subscribed to the New York Times crossword subscription, which gets you every day's puzzle, but also gets you the entire archive. And so I just worked back from 1996, which is when they started putting the puzzle online. I just solved from 1996 all the way through 2007, you know, not all in a row at the same time, but gradually. Did the entire archive of those.
Were the answers different other, you know, in, like, 1996? Does it have a lot to do with anything, like, current and what's happening in the world, or is it just pretty much the same old kind of thing every year?
It's basically the same. The puzzles have gotten much better in the last 10 years, partly because there are more people making puzzles, and thus there's more competition to get into the New York Times. Technology has gotten better. People use crossword programs and databases and word lists to put together their puzzles. You know, in the 90s, most people were still constructing by hand, I think, which is a sort of still a good skill to have if you're a puzzle maker, to be able to sit down with graph paper and make a puzzle. But you really don't have to anymore. There's programs that will help set up the grid and suggest answers. You know, if you've got an A as the second letter and an I as the sixth letter and use all those blanks, you can get a list of the possible words that will fit there. So you can pick the most interesting one and then keep moving on.
That's interesting. So I never really thought about that being a thing, that there'd be a computer program to create the puzzle. That seems a little bit unfair, but I guess with the amount of puzzles that need to be put out. I guess you got to do that.
Yeah, and people use the software to different degrees. The best puzzle makers are still using their own ingenuity as the primary driver. You know, you can't come up with a great gimmick or puns or whatever. You know, the computer can't be funny or clever. But once you get the skeleton in there and you just have to fill the rest of the puzzle with the rest of the words, people have even developed their own algorithms to use the word list to get the optimally best fill in the puzzle, because everything in the word list might have a ranking on it, you know, a numerical ranking based on how good of a word it is. You know, more interesting words, common words that have less common letters, you know, J's and Q's and X's, those are better to have in a puzzle because they're not, you know, you don't see them as often. Whereas, like, abbreviations or Roman numerals or foreign words, those would have lower scores. And there are algorithms that can fill in the whole thing to maximize the quality of the words. Now, you don't let the computer do the whole job, but you might, you know, you'll kind of go piece by piece in conjunction with the software that's helping just narrow down the words. And, and put that all together. Now, I mean, there are also some newspaper, you know, cheapo syndicated crosswords that appear in free papers that are entirely made by crossword, that are entirely made by computers. The computer can just pick one of its stock, you know, grids, you know, patterns of black squares, and then just throw a bunch of words in that all fit together, that are all valid dictionary words, and then take a whole bunch of clues from a database that have been used before and, you know, send that right out. So there are some completely computer generated puzzles in newspapers.
Yeah, wasn't there a sort of controversy recently about a guy who had been plagiarizing or allegedly plagiarizing old puzzles?
Yeah, it is confirmed. His employer confirmed that he was plagiarizing puzzles, and the former editor of the USA Today crossword puzzle, who has long been known to be incompetent, but was recently proven to also be dishonest and a plagiarist. I don't know. He claimed in an interview that there was sort of technological problems that caused it, but I don't. You know, nobody buys that. It's not really. I don't think that's really related. It was a database, however, that exposed these, you know, this copying, which found is a crossword fan who's also a programmer, put together a database in order to compare puzzles and see if there were similarities between past puzzles, and, you know, popped up a whole bunch of USA Today puzzles that were very similar to New York Times puzzles.
And you don't think that there's any way that was just a coincidence, or with the amount of puzzles being created constantly, you know? I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not really possible for it to be a coincidence. Not in that, to that degree. There was the big article on 538.com that sort of publicized this controversy. You know, they, and, you know, of course, they're into data journalism, and so they basically proved that there were some, let's say, I think 65 USA Today puzzles that used the same theme answers, the long answers, as a New York Times puzzle that had appeared previously. There were no other outlet had more than like five, you know, so that's happened a couple times where, like, the Los Angeles Times had a puzzle that had the same theme answers as a New York Times puzzle. That happened five times over 20 years, as opposed to 65 times over 10 years. It's a statistically significant difference. So I suppose it's possible that Mr. Parker had used a database to collect theme ideas that he was going to use later, and then just got really sloppy about when he was using his puzzles, I think that's the argument that most journalistic plagiarizers use, like, oh, it was just the wrong, you know, I didn't have it in my notes, that this was not a, that this needed to be attributed or something like that. But knowing how shady this guy has always been, nobody really believes that that he was just, it was just a coincidence. He was also very shoddy about the puzzles were low quality compared to all the other newspaper puzzles in terms of, you know, he would use a lot more obscure, crappy words in the fill, which with a little effort could have been made a lot better. And just inconsistent themes, just all sorts of kind of shoddy puzzle making. And then and the other thing that was found is he was just republishing things. You know, 10 years later, he would take the same puzzle, slap a fake name on it, and publish it in another outlet. And that is not illegal because he's stealing from himself, and he has the rights to do that, but that's just lazy.
So he was stealing his own puzzles and just republishing them?
Yeah, he was just reusing them, which has been, you know, other puzzle makers have run a rerun, basically, you know, it's a rerun this week. You know, this is a one from 10 years ago. And yeah, after 10 years, no one's going to remember doing that crossword puzzle. I don't remember a week ago's puzzles, usually, let alone 10 years. But there were hundreds and hundreds of puzzles that Timothy Parker republished from one of his two outlets to another. And that's just, yeah, that was not, again, yeah, not not illegal, just shoddy.
Now, when you do puzzles every day, does it ever feel like you're doing homework, or do you still really enjoy every puzzle that you do?
Occasionally it does. More and more, I guess, over the years, it's felt like a chore to keep up. I mean, it doesn't usually, but I do feel like I need to solve all of the current puzzles just to keep in practice. If I get really busy in life or on vacation or whatever, I might let it go for a week and then have to catch up, but and then feel like I've got to catch up. But usually those cycles will go in and out. So I'll, you know, it'll be fun again a week later.
So do you feel like you've reached the point where just regular puzzles aren't enough anymore?
Yeah, I guess. I think I could be satisfied enough if I only had to do regular crosswords for the rest of my life. But it's fun to change it up with other types. There's cryptic crosswords, and then a sort of the third branch is variety crosswords, which are have standard crossword style clues, except the grids are in totally different shapes. These are like what are in the New York Times Magazine as the second Sunday puzzle a lot of times. So it might be a spiral with words going in and out, or around corners, or there's various different shapes of puzzles where the words still intersect with each other, but because of the mechanisms of it, you get more interesting words. So those are also fun.
Are there any crossword puzzles you can't solve?
I can't solve British cryptic crosswords. As for standard American crosswords, though, I have trouble with the very hardest of them, but it's still rare that that I can't solve it in, you know, in 10 minutes or so on the very hardest ones.
Now, I want to talk about what happened this year, which I'm sure is slightly a sore subject for you. This is the first year that you've lost the ACPT. How did that feel when that happened? Were you disappointed, or?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, of course, I was disappointed. It's never fun to lose, especially when you've grown accustomed to winning. But my friend won, so I was happy for him, you know. Howard Barkin, who has been a friend of mine since the first tournament I showed up at, and even online before that, who's generally considered one of the nicest people in a room full of very nice people at these crossword events. He'd been in the finals 4 times and lost 4 times, so everybody in the room is very happy for him to win, and so I couldn't be too mad, because he was getting, you know, somebody else to win for the first time is great.
Can you explain what happened?
I don't really have an explanation, except that he just did better than I at that on that final puzzle. They're really hard. The harder the puzzle is, the more sort of variance there will be in a solving time, because if you happen to know a couple things, or if you happen to get the right letters in the right places to be able to see one thing, and then work off of that, then you might be able to do it faster. Specifically in this year's final puzzle, there was, you know, there's big chunks of white space, you know, there's sort of different quadrants of a crossword grid, and Howard, who won, happened to start solving in this one part, like in the bottom right corner. He finished that first and then moved to the rest of it, and I and David Plotkin, who finished third, we both ended up with that as the last section, and there was one really tricky answer where we both guessed wrong and filled in some letters that you know, Howard did not fall into that trap, because he had already gotten those letters from the other side. None of this was intentional, it just, he happened to avoid a trap that, you know, because of where he got his first answers. There's not really a strategy in how you solve a puzzle from start to finish. Usually you want to, you know, most people start at one across. That's at the very, you know, the top of the list of clues. On an easy puzzle, you can start there and get some answers and just keep building off of that. In a really hard puzzle, you just look for anything that you know for sure and fill that in and then try to build off that. And that's usually, you know, not going to be in the top left corner necessarily. So you just flail until you get a little foothold, and then keep building off of that.
What was the time difference between you and him?
It was about a minute, and that's out of, you know, 7 or 8 minutes total. So, you know, that was a pretty decisive victory. I felt that I was doing pretty well. Last year, I won by 1 second over the second place finisher. And in that last year, I did not feel like I was solving very smoothly or very well. I kept getting stuck at these, you know, a certain point. So last year, I was definitely worried as I was solving. I knew I wasn't doing all that well. This year, I thought I was doing well. You know, it wasn't the most blazingly fast I've ever been, but I did not think I was going to lose. I thought I was doing pretty well. But, you know, Howard just got into a groove and raced to the finish.
Are you ready for next year to go for 7 and tie the number one?
Yeah, right. Though, the career name? John Delphin is the career title holder. Who, not coincidentally, is also a theatrical pianist and music director. He was actually one of my inspirations. He was one of the stars of the movie Wordplay, as one of the favorites every year. He was one of the subjects, and when I saw the movie, I was like, oh my god, that guy does the same thing that I do. That's cool. There's some sort of cognitive connection between music and math and crossword puzzles, I think. I'm certainly not thinking about next year at all. It's like 9 months away at this time of recording. I like that I don't, or say, like, that's my making excuses, but I'm glad I don't have the pressure of having a streak going anymore. I had said that if I won 8 times in a row, then I would just retire and quit on top or whatever. So now I don't have to quit anymore because I'm not going to win 8 in a row. So I'll definitely keep trying to, you know, to break that career record, and then sort of see what happens from there.
Do you have a plan of when you may retire from this?
No, I don't. I thought, I mean, I sort of was a little bit of hubris saying that a couple years ago when I hadn't really been challenged. I won the first few times, I won by decent margins, but then last year I won by 1 second, and this year I lost by a minute. So, you know, I felt like, oh, if it's just not fair, if no one can get close to me, then this is not going to be fun for anybody anymore. But clearly, plenty of other people do have a chance at winning, so it's not like I have to step aside for fairness' sake or anything like that. There's also the chance, now that I live in San Francisco, I had lived on the East Coast for years, and now the last few years I've been flying across the country to the tournament, and I may not always be able to do that. The life of an artist, you don't always get to make your own schedule, take days off work whenever you want. So I've been lucky so far that I haven't had any major, I say lucky that I haven't had any big jobs, but I haven't had any major conflicts that I've had to choose between doing a particular show and doing the tournament, but I'm sure that will come up someday down the line, so I won't feel like I have to be there every year. But no, I don't necessarily have any plans to quit at any time.
Well, Dan, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today.
Sure. And, absolutely. I hope it's somewhat interesting to your listeners.